It's interesting that in most congregations, when trouble occurs, it usually comes in multiples. Almost every group that I've been with, it's just very intriguing that when bad times start occurring in the life of one, it's not long before you see that somewhat multiplied. And I think that's been the case here at Gooch Lane for the past few months. There have been a number of people who have had their share of suffering for various reasons, whether it be physical illness, illness of family members, just a variety of things. And so for Christians, the question might be then, how do we handle that? How do we deal with those kinds of things? Well, as we heard in our reading this morning, James clues us in on that when he says in almost the introduction of his book, the second verse of it, he says, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet various trials of various kinds." And so we look at this, and what James is saying is when bad things happen, there may be some very good that comes out of that. There may be things that happen that should bring us joy. And sometimes that's a little difficult to understand. Sometimes difficult to try to appreciate what James is saying here. And so this morning, what I'd like for us to do is to talk about finding those good lessons in bad times. And while we will be back to James 1, I'd like for us to begin in a different place. While James tells us about these trials that come upon us, I want us to speak first of all about the trials we bring on ourselves. Are there lessons that you and I can learn even from that? That when we have done things that are just wrong, things that we knew better than to do, and bad things happen as a result of that, are there things to learn from it? And I think the answer to that is yes. That when bad times come by falling into temptation, we can find good from that. Let's begin this morning by looking over to Hebrews chapter 12. The Lord here is discussing what He does when we do things that are wrong. Actually, I think there's a couple of ideas going on here in Hebrews chapter 12. You've got the idea of the Lord disciplining us. And sometimes discipline just simply means taking us from better to even better than that. Exercising a discipline that's going to make us a better individual. And sometimes discipline is the traditional sense of the term, where we are being punished for something that we've done. And that seems to be the way that the writer here is leaning. And I would refer back to the quote in verses 5 and 6, when he says, "And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by Him." That's the idea of corrected by Him. "For the Lord disciplines the one He loves and chastises every son whom He receives." Now, with that in mind, go down just a few verses to verse 9 and listen to what the writer says here. He says, "Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but He disciplines us for our good, that we may share in His holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it." You look at this, and the writer says, now just reason this out. We are, when we become adults, happy that our parents disciplined us. We are happy that we didn't get away with everything. We are happy that when we did something bad, the rod of correction was there to get us back on the straight and narrow. He says, now if we appreciate that with parents, think about how much we should appreciate it when the Lord, who knows the right answer in every situation, corrects us in the way that we should go. Now, with all of that being said, and with all of that in mind, let's look at a couple of examples. A couple of places where the Lord takes people who got themselves in bad situations and disciplines them, and then we'll note the results of that. The first one, perhaps one of the most unusual cases within the entire Bible, is found back in Daniel chapter 4. You'll remember that this is talking about King Nebuchadnezzar. And as we look here at King Nebuchadnezzar, we find that the Lord was using him very much as His own personal tool. The Lord had things that needed to be done to His people Judah, and Nebuchadnezzar is employed to carry those out. And so Nebuchadnezzar, if we look down in verse 28, we find that some things are about to happen here. Let's just read here beginning in 28 and looking down through 32. He says, "All of this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar at the end of 12 months. He was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. And the king answered and said, Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?" While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And you shall be driven out among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom He will." Here's Nebuchadnezzar. He had been allowed to carry out the Lord's judgment. You ever thought about that? Nebuchadnezzar had been the king who was allowed to destroy the temple of God. Now, oftentimes in that time period of history, if you could destroy a god's temple, that meant that you or your god was more powerful. And the Lord has made it very clear to Nebuchadnezzar throughout all of this, "I am letting you do these things. I am letting you bring judgment on my people. I am letting you to destroy my temple, not by your own power." But Nebuchadnezzar failed to realize that. And as we come to chapter 4 here, we find Nebuchadnezzar has greatly expanded in his view of himself. He's viewing himself as this great and powerful king. And in our reading, you notice all of the personal pronouns. "Look what I have done. This is by my hand. This is for my majesty that these things are happening." And the Lord says, "No. You have placed yourself in a situation where you must be disciplined." And the Lord brings a very unusual discipline upon him. He takes him from being this great and powerful king to an animal out grazing in the field. There's not a whole lot more that I can think of that would humiliate and would humble someone as the fact that you are leaving this grand palace to be out in the dew eating the grass. And so the Lord said there's a lesson to learn, and I believe that lesson was learned. After all of this is over, we find that King Nebuchadnezzar sees his pride. He sees the things that are happening. And we go over to verse 34 and listen to the words that he speaks here. It says, "At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored Him who lives forever. For His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are counted as nothing, and He does according to His will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay His hand or say to Him, 'What have you done?'" You notice some pronoun changes there? It's no longer me. It's no longer my. It's no longer I. It's what He has done. His power, His ability. The lesson was learned. Nebuchadnezzar is an interesting fellow. Nebuchadnezzar, at least in this point in his life, had been humbled to the point where with the discipline of God, he was taken from that haughty outlook and made to realize that everything is under the control of God. That's what the Lord's discipline can do when we get ourselves in bad situations. Let's look at a second example. A man who by all accounts may have looked like a very good man to many people. Here was an up-and-coming Jewish man, probably was on his way to being one of the more powerful of the Jewish elders. This group of Christians was causing problems. They were speaking bad things, at least according to the Jews, about Judaism. And here is this man who is ready to do something about it. Acts chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, it says, "But Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem." Here was a man who said, "We are going to stamp out this Christianity. We are going to commit them to prison. We are going to stop this message from being spoken." He needed discipline. Because he had gotten himself in a very bad situation. Why? Because of his own making. Here he had had men speaking the truth to him. He had heard men like Stephen, as well as many others, who were preaching this message of salvation, but yet he refused to accept that. He refused to listen. And because of that, the discipline of the Lord had to come. And it did. And what we find is that his actions brought bad times. You look on down to verses 8 and 9. It says, Saul rose from the ground, and although his eyes were opened, he saw nothing. And they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. And for 3 days he was without sight and neither ate nor drank. Now we compare that to Nebuchadnezzar and we say, well, now this seems to be a little bit less of a punishment. This seems to be less of a discipline. How many of you would like to go 3 days without sight? Any volunteers? Anybody willing to say, I'm going to give up my sight? No. Because we love the independence that it gives us. We love the fact that we can see what's coming. We love the fact of this gift that God has given. But the Apostle Paul needed it removed. He needed to spend 3 days in darkness so that he could see the light of God. He needed to spend time in reflection over these things he had heard on the road to Damascus so that he could understand what it meant to be a follower of God. And because of this discipline that the Lord gave, the apostle was able to see. He was able to come to the sense of understanding what he needed to do, and he did it. Now, we could look at other examples. But from these two men, I would tell us this, we don't need to be surprised when bad things happen to us because of our failure to withstand temptation. Here was Nebuchadnezzar in his pride. Here was the Apostle Paul also in his pride. The refusal to listen to the message of God. Peter, I believe, would amen this point, and so does, when he says over in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 15, as he's talking about suffering, he says, let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or as a meddler. What he's saying is when you are involved in these kinds of things, bad times are going to come. And when you and I involve ourselves in such, we don't need to be shocked when we pay the price for that. Now, with that being said, I think we need to understand something. These bad times may very well be God teaching us that a change is needed in our lives. When we look at these things, we need to understand that God may be sending us a message. How many of us like to be around adults who were not disciplined as children? How many times do we like being around someone whose parents let him or her do absolutely everything, and when the child got in trouble, there was the constant bailing out. There was the constant going in and trying to take care of the action, and the child being completely sheltered from any responsibilities or any kind of discipline that would come. We know that those kind of kids typically grow up to be rotten adults. They grow up to be people who have no sense of responsibility. Now, if we understand that, how much more should we understand when a child of God is disciplined so that he can grow into what he needs to be? When we get ourselves in trouble, let's not start pointing the finger at God. And when bad things result from those troubles, saying, Lord, you know, I've asked your forgiveness. Why are you letting these things happen to me? That's the wrong approach to this. Because the Lord does offer that forgiveness, but the Lord very well may be teaching us, don't go back that route again. And so I would say to us that when our world is crashing down around us, it may be because we're living in the wrong world. It may be the fact that we need to return to the ways of God, and the Lord is seeking to show us that very point. He did with Nebuchadnezzar. He did with the Apostle Paul, and I firmly believe He'll do it with us as well. Now, what about when bad times happen not for that reason? It's not because we brought it on ourselves. It's not because we've been involved in bad things, but simply bad things happen because bad things happen. How do we deal with that kind of situation? And sometimes this will be occasions when we are tested the most, when we'll decide whether or not we are going to truly trust that God is going to provide a solution for those things. I'd like for us once again to turn to someone in the Bible to illustrate this point. When we think about how these bad times should be dealt with, I want us to go back and look to a woman who experienced a great deal of trouble. If you go back with me to the book of Ruth, we're going to start just right very near the beginning in chapter 1. And I want you to note what's said here about this woman by the name of Naomi. Verse 3, now let me kind of set things up. I think we know the account, but just to remind us, famine had hit the land. We find that Naomi's family, her husband, her sons, they had gone into the land of Moab in order to live there. And while all of this was happening, the sons took wives. And then we look in verse 3 and it says, "But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. They lived there about 10 years. But both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband." There are some who try to say this is punishment for going in the land of Moab. To that I would say that is sheer conjecture. The passage tells us nothing about that. In fact, from everything we find, it looks like bad things happened because bad things happened. Here was a woman who lost her husband. She lost her sons. We understand how difficult that was. And I want us to note here the reaction that she has to that. She goes back home. And as she enters into her village, I want you to listen to what she says. Verse 19, Ruth is with her, of course, here. It says, "So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, 'Is this Naomi?'" Now listen to what she says. Verse 20, she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi, but call me Mara," meaning bitterness. "For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? And when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me." You and I look at her statement, and I think most of us would sympathize. A woman who is a widow in the 21st century experiences sorrow, but she would not experience the life that a woman of this time period would have. Here is a woman who lost her means of support, who lost her family. It was a terrible plight. And listen to her words. But as we listen to those words, I think there is correction that needs to be made. Because as Naomi was looking at all of these bad things in her life, what was she failing to see? Well, look in verse 22. "So Ruth," Naomi returned, "and Ruth, the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her." Yes, bad times had come. Yes, there were difficult times. But I think what happened here was Naomi was so focused on the bad that she failed to see what the Lord had provided for her. Here is this young woman who said, "I'm going back with you. I'll forfeit another marriage, if that's what it means. I'm staying with you." And during these early days of their return, what is Ruth doing? She's providing. She's taking care. She's gleaning. She's going out in the fields. She's doing everything. You see, Naomi had focused so much on the bad that she could not see that the Lord had provided very much for her. And I think oftentimes in hard times, that's exactly what happens to us. Many times when these hard times come, we are confronted with what kind of attitude we're going to take about them. We are confronted about the things that are happening. And I'm going to tell you, the Lord does not expect some Pollyanna attitude. He doesn't expect for us just to treat troubles that come along lightly and, well, it's no big deal, and we try to put on this false front and false face. That's not what He's asking of us. What He wants, though, is for us to trust in Him. And as in the case of Naomi, He wants appreciation for the help that He sends. What we might not have ever seen were it not for those hard times. And that in turn circles us back to the book of James. And as we think about James chapter 1, James is telling us here, we need to have joy in those times that come. I want to note something with you here. James chapter 1, as he talks about these trials of various kinds, I have to depend on someone smarter than me for this, but those who know the language say that that is almost a generic term that can mean either things that are coming because of our faith or things that are coming just because they come. It can be the testing of our faith, or it can be just the bad times that we're talking about here. I wonder if perhaps James just left that purposely vague, so that when he could say, yes, you're being tested because of your faith, have joy in that. Or when bad times come along, that in turn are going to help also in building your faith, have joy in those as well. So what do we find? As these bad times come in our lives, what are the good things that we're going to gain from it? Well, James tells us. The first thing he says to us is that this is going to produce a steadfastness within you, or an endurance within you, as verse 3 says. When he says, for you know that the testing of your faith, whether that be a direct link with we have taken a stand for Christ and we are suffering for it, or whether it be that bad times have come upon us and we are being tested as far as how we're going to trust God, whichever the case, he says it is going to build a steadfastness in you that's going to help you in your walk here in this life. And that idea of steadfastness is a very strong, aggressive word. It's the idea that we are enduring in the face of any kind of hardship that comes upon us, so that when it is completed, we have a stronger and a deeper faith. That's what hard times can do for us. And so when James says to us, you can be joyful in that, you can be happy in it, what he's saying is that it is producing this within you. You know, that concept is throughout the New Testament. We think about what the Apostle Paul said in Romans 5, verses 3 and 4. He said, not only that, but we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. The Apostle Paul's echoing that idea. What James tells us, he tells us as well. We think about what the Apostle Peter says in this regard. He says in chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, in this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. He says something else as well over in 2 Peter chapter 1. He says, and we're picking up kind of in his list here, and knowledge with self-control, and self-control with steadfastness. That's our idea. And steadfastness with godliness. In all of these things, we are being told that when we face hard times, it can make us better servants of the Lord. You and I both know that rarely is anything good gained easily. Have a talk with an athlete. Is an athlete going to wake up one morning and decide, hey, I'm going to get the best time ever in a 5K run? No. It's training. It's endurance. And I can tell you there are times when those muscles are screaming at the athlete, stop what you're doing. This is painful. And the athlete has to say no. Because what I'm going through now is making me better for things to come. I'm going to tell you, when bad times come, really our first thought is, when will they be over? I want it done with. I want to be finished with it. And I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thought. But when they linger, when they're around, perhaps it's at that time we say, what are the things that I need to be gaining from them? Because what we find is that trials are a part of the refining process. When gold is purified, it passes through the fire. When you and I are purified, metaphorically speaking, we pass through that fire as well. We're purified. So therefore, we should not face these things with cowardice or self-pity or say, why is the Lord letting all this happen to me? No, just the opposite. We say, with the Lord's help, I can endure. With the Lord's help, I can get through this. And when we do that, we are well on the road to developing that reliance on Him, that steadfastness that James says we can have. But he goes on. And he says, also with these trials, you can find yourself being perfect and complete. We continue on. We look in verse 4, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. I think there's two ideas we need to look at with this. We first understand that steadfastness is leading us to be a mature person. You see, maturity doesn't throw hands in the air and say, well, why would the Lord let all of this happen to me? Why doesn't the Lord save me from these things? No, that's not maturity. And so as we go through these trials and these struggles, that steadfastness is bringing us to be a more mature Christian. Think about what Paul says. As he writes to the Ephesians, he says, and he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. We look at this and we understand that when we are growing more mature, it's going to help us in other ways, isn't it? These hard times come, it's leading us toward maturity. This maturity is going to help us to view the hard times in a way that's going to create stability within our lives. Isn't that what the writer of Hebrews states when he tells us, but solid food is for the mature, for those who have their powers of discernment trained by constant practice to distinguish good from evil. Maturity is what we're striving for. And sometimes these hard times, these bad times that come because bad times come, are going to lead us in that direction. But I want us to think about a second part of this as well. James also states that you'll be lacking in nothing. We understand that maturity is going to help us to grow. But what does James mean when he says we'll be lacking in nothing? I believe what James is telling us in this is that we'll probably only know this full maturity when we look upon the face of God. But we're growing. These hard times are making us better people while we're here on this earth. They're making us stronger. They're making us endure. But he says, if you'll just hang in there, there will come a time when you will lack nothing. You see, even the most mature Christian on the face of the earth is going to succumb to temptation now and again. But there will come a day when we have been with the Lord, and the Lord says to us, welcome home, when we'll find no lack of anything we need. And that rugged endurance, that maturity of godliness, will bring us to know that there is nothing lacking, that we are now in the presence of the Lord. Which I believe leads us to the third of these benefits. And that's the idea that when we allow this to have an impact on our life like James tells us to, we are going to better see our need for God. You look on down just a little bit further, and he says in verse 5, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith with no doubting. Here we are in a situation where these bad times come and we don't know exactly how to deal with it. And James says to us, you know what it's doing? It's telling you, you need to have a closer relationship with God. Ask Him for that wisdom and He's going to provide it for you. We ask with wisdom that we are assured that God is going to provide. And let me tell you, sometimes finding that wisdom may be a little bit of a challenge. Sometimes it's a little difficult to find it. But nonetheless, if we trust in God, we understand that He has been gracious to make that promise to us. And so the bad times that we go through, perhaps even those times we bring on ourselves if we'll develop the right attitude afterward, but especially those times that just come because they come, those are going to help us to realize our total dependence on God. And when we can allow that to happen, we know that God is there for us, that He hears our petitions, and that He will make us what we need to be. And so I would just simply ask all of us this. Isn't it a comfort to know that we have a good God in bad times? That no matter what may happen here, no matter what may come, God is steady. God is faithful. And God will help us to be the kind of people that will one day be welcomed home into heaven. And so I would just offer you this word of encouragement this morning, if you are going through hard times, to think very carefully on what you're learning from that. To think about how you're facing it. And if you are going through good times right now, realize they won't last. I don't think I'm speaking with the voice of pessimism, but rather just we know times are going to come. Question is, how will we look to God in those occasions? How are we going to face those times in our lives? And if we can trust that what James says is true, then we can trust that we will grow in our spirituality here, but even more than that, we're being refined to one day be in the presence of God.